Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster Cicely Tiernan bringing you today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. Business. More big companies bet they can still grow without hiring. JP Morgan Chase has a strong bias against adding staff while Walmart is keeping its headcount flat. Major employers are in a new ultra-lean era by Chip Cutter. It's the corporate gamble of the moment. Can you run a company increasing sales and juicing profits without adding people? American employers are increasingly making their calculation that they can keep the size of their teams flat or shrink through layoffs without harming their businesses. Part of that thinking is the belief that artificial intelligence will be used to pick up some of the slack around and automate more processes. Companies are also hesitant to make any moves in an economy many still describe as uncertain. JP Morgan Chase's chief financial officer told investors recently that the bank now has a very strong bias against having the reflective response to hire more people for any given need. Aerospace and defense company RTX boasted last week that its sales rose even more without adding employees. Goldman Sachs, meanwhile, sent a memo to staffers this month saying that the firm will constrain headcount growth through the end of the year and will reduce roles that could be more efficient with AI. Walmart, the nation's largest private employer, said it also plans to keep its headcount roughly flat over the next 3 years, even as sales grow. If people are getting more productive, you don't need to hire more people, Brian Chesky, Airbnb's chief executive, said in an interview. I see a lot of companies preemptively holding the line, forecasting and hoping they can have smaller workforces. Airbnb employees around 7,000 people, said Chesky, said, although he doesn't expect that number to grow much over the next year. With the help of AI, he said he hopes the team we already have can get considerably more work done. Many companies seem intent on embracing the new ultra-lean model of staffing, one where more roles are kept unfilled and hiring is treated as a last resort. At Intuit, every time a job comes open, managers are pushed to justify why they need to backfill it, says Sandeep Ajula, the company's chief financial officer. The new rigor around hiring helps combat corporate bloat. The typical behavior that sets in, and we're still all guilty of it, is, historically, if somebody leaves, if Jane Doe leaves, I've got to backfill Jane, Ajula says in an interview. Now when someone quits, the company asks, is there an opportunity to rethink how we staff? The ROI of AI. Intuit has chosen not to replace certain roles in its finance, legal, and customer support functions, he said. In its last fiscal year, the company's revenue rose 16% even as its headcount stayed flat, and it is planning only modest hiring in the current year. The desire to avoid hiring or filling jobs reflects a growing push among executives to see a return on their AI spending. On earnings calls, mentions of ROI and AI investments are increasing, according to an analyst by AlphaSense, reflecting heightened interest from analysts and investors that companies make good on the millions they are pouring into AI. Many executives hope that software coding assistants and armies of digital agents will keep improving, even if the current results still at times leave something to be desired. The widespread caution in hiring now is frustrating job seekers and leading many employees within organizations to feel stuck in place, unable to ascend or take new roles, workers and bosses say. Inside many large companies, HR chiefs also say it is becoming increasingly difficult to predict just how many employees will be needed as technology takes more of the work. Some employers seem to think that fewer employees will actually improve operations. Meta Platforms this past week said it is cutting 600 jobs in the AI division, a move some leaders hailed as a way to cut down on bureaucracy. By reducing the size of our team, fewer conversations will be required to make a decision, and each person will be more load-bearing and have more scope and impact, Alexander Wang, Meta's chief AI officer, wrote in a memo to staff seen by the Wall Street Journal. The layoffs haven't been widespread through the economy. Some companies are making cuts. Target on Thursday said it would cut about 1,000 corporate employees and close another 800 open positions, totaling around 8% of its corporate workforce. Michael Fiddleke, Target's incoming CEO, said in a memo sent to staff that too many layers and overlapping work have slowed decisions, making it harder to bring ideas to life. A range of other employers, from the electric truck maker Rivian to cable and broadcast provider Charter Communications, have announced their own staff cuts in recent weeks, too. Operating with fewer people can still pose risks for companies by straining existing staffers or hurting efforts to develop future leaders, executives and economists say. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, said Matthew Martin, senior U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. You want to keep your headcount costs down now, but you also have to keep an eye on the future. Real estate. Renters have the upper hand, and they are probably keeping it. Apartment rents nationally are advancing at their slowest pace in years because glut of new units is taking longer to absorb than expected. By Rebecca Picciotta. Renters across much of the U.S. have enjoyed easing prices and months of free rent this year. Now this tenant-friendly environment looks poised to extend deep into next year and perhaps beyond. Apartment rents nationally are advancing at their slowest pace in years, thanks to the glut of new units that has taken longer than expected to absorb. Most recently, job concerns among young people are posing a new threat to the rental market. The U.S. unemployment rate for people aged 20 to 24 was 9.2% in August, more than double the overall rate. If a weaker job market continues, it could lead more of the renters to seek roommates or move back with their family rather than get their own place. Annika Nelson, 22 years old, graduated from North Dakota State University in May. She planned to move to a Denver rental with her fiancé this summer as soon as she secured a job, but 5 months and more than 50 applications later, she is still job hunting. In October, the couple rented a place in Denver without jobs. It helped that their landlord offered them 12 weeks of free rent to sign a lease in a newly constructed building with a gym, co-working space, rooftop deck, and a pool. But if she cannot land a job, she'll likely move back home to South Dakota. A lot of people my age are doing that right now, she said. National rent prices edged slightly higher for part of this year, buoyed by price rises in the Northeast and Midwest, where new supply has been limited. But last month, national average rent fell 0.3% from August, the steepest September drop in more than 15 years, according to data firm CoStar. Landlords in many major metro areas are slashing prices. Those in the Sun Belt and Mountain West states are offering the deepest rent reductions, especially in cities like Austin, Denver, and Phoenix. Multifamily owners and analysts anticipated that 2025 would be the year that surplus supply balanced out and they regained their pricing power. Instead, landlords are now betting on the ability to raise rents by the end of 2026 or at least sometime in 2027. Even that might be wishful thinking. Analysts at data company Yardi Matrix recently lowered their projections for 2027 rent growth. They expect more tepid growth that year because of more new apartments coming online than originally expected. Previously, reliable demand drivers are starting to fizzle. Hiring for entry-level jobs is tightening. Employment growth is decelerating in cities like Denver and Las Vegas. What you don't forecast is job anxiety being as deep as I think it is, said Tony Giulianelle, chief executive of real estate investment firm Atlas Real Estate. Sluggish rent growth is good news for the inflation backdrop, since housing is the largest component of the consumer price index. Annual inflation heated up slightly in September, but it was less than expected in part because of modest rent increases. During the early years of the pandemic, developers raced to capitalize on historically low borrowing rates and population migration to the Sun Belt. That resulted in the biggest apartment construction boom in four decades. But supply chain delays and construction labor shortages dragged out development so that even when cities were oversaturated with new apartments, there were still more coming. Remote workers who once helped power the Sun Belt's overpopulation boom are getting called back to the office. And as President Trump cracks down on international immigration, the influx of new foreign residents is also slowing. There was a saying, stay alive until 2025, said David Schwartz, chief executive of real estate investment firm Waterton. We're in the camp. We'll be in heaven in 2027. Until then, landlords are relying on months of free rent, shopping gift cards, free parking, or even paying for moving costs just to get tenants to sign a lease. When that isn't enough, they resort to cutting their prices. Apartments are getting leased at record levels, but that is largely because of the supply and because building owners are offering more tenant incentives. They agreed to concessions such as months of free rent on 37% of rentals in September, a record for that month, according to Zillow. Some of the signs emerged this summer. Typically, the hottest leasing season of the year, when college graduates start new jobs and rent new apartments, this summer saw national rent growth cool even further, said Grant Montgomery, CoStar's National Director of Multifamily Analytics. Empty apartments sat on the market slightly longer this summer compared with last year, according to apartment list data. 2025 was the year without a summer leasing season, Montgomery said. We really started to see the air come out of rents. Spencer McCain is one of the beneficiaries. The 29-year-old video game programmer has been renting a one-bedroom apartment in Denver at roughly the same $1,575 a month for the past 3 years. That comfortably makes up less than 30% of his income. This year, his landlord is charging him for only 9 months of rent on his 11-month lease. I just got 2 months off, said McCain. World, the effort to court Trump abroad, deals, flattery, and jet fighters. Lavish welcoming ceremonies and nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize are part of foreign leaders' charm offensives when the American president comes to town, by Alexander Ward, Gabrielle Steinhauser, and Meredith McGraw. World leaders have developed something of a blueprint for President Trump when he comes to visit. Produce a lavish welcoming ceremony and launch a charm offensive in hopes of securing relief from U.S. tariffs and demand to spend more on defense. Recent overseas trips have involved escorting Air Force One with jet fighters during its final approach and lining red carpets with uniformed soldiers and traditional dancers. Upon Trump's arrival, foreign hosts often exalt him for his role in reaching a significant trade or peace deal. There have been repeated pledges to nominate the president for the Nobel Peace Prize. Foreign leaders have long used presidential visits to curry favor with the man in the Oval Office. However, Trump has, more than many of his predecessors, used the economic and military might of the U.S. to put pressure on and extract concessions from countries around the world, upping the stakes for leaders to find their way into the president's good graces. The emerging diplomatic script was on full display Saturday in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Malaysia sent an F-18 to flank the president's plane before it landed at the city's airport. Anwar Ibrahim, Malaysia's prime minister, awaited the president at the bottom of the stairs alongside troops and dozens of dancers. Trump even joined in the festivities, pumping his fists and swaying to the rhythm of the music, and then waving the Malaysian and U.S. flags in unison. The president added his own flourish by welcoming Anwar into his presidential limousine, known as the Beast, before speeding together to a summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations here. When the president arrived, he asked me to join him in the car. I said, "That's against the security of protocol rules," and he was delighted to break the rules, Anwar said as he regaled the audience soon after. It was a nice ride. Meanwhile, moments later, at the signing of a peace deal between Cambodia and Thailand, the U.S. helped finalize, Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Manet said Trump deserved the Nobel, while Anwar lauded Trump for your tenacity, your courage. Cambodia and Thailand clashed in July over a long-running border dispute. Trump threatened to suspend tariff relief if they didn't reach a ceasefire, pressuring the two countries' leaders into talks mediated by Malaysia. The pageantry, which echoed similar ceremonies that welcomed Trump in the Middle East earlier this year, shows how U.S. partners try to flatter and sway the U.S. president. To succeed, world capitals carefully track comments from Trump and those around him for topics that can land them in the president's good graces, officials from multiple countries have said. The pomp and circumstance, at times beyond what other U.S. presidents have enjoyed, shows that many nations now put as much thought into the airport reception and symmetry as they do into policy deliverables when Trump comes to town. But it also underscores the stakes for any future trip, as every country feels pressure to orchestrate a lavish event that rivals the others, creating a sort of hospitality arms race for any Trump visit. At the same time, the president's counterparts have to balance pleasing Trump with messaging strength to their own constituents. The Malaysian government did not respond to a request for comment. President Trump has effectively restored America's standing as leader of the free world, and foreign nations are enthusiastic to strengthen their relationships with our country under this president's leadership, wrote Anna Kelly, a White House spokeswoman. Kuala Lumpur, Trump's first stop, set the tone for the week-long Asia swing. Southeast Asian leaders who were gathered here cottoned onto Trump's desire to present himself as a global peacemaker. The American president got the first word at a signing ceremony for an agreement that ended 5 days of border clashes between Cambodia and Thailand that killed dozens of people and displaced thousands. "I love doing it," Trump said of his efforts to resolve conflicts. "I shouldn't say it's a hobby because it's so much more serious than a hobby, but it's something that I'm good at, and it's something I love to do." In a news conference after the signing ceremony, Shahusk Pugtikau, Thailand's foreign minister, said the deal wasn't actually a peace treaty that resolved the politically sensitive and century-old border dispute between his country and Cambodia. Instead, the leaders signed a joint declaration on the outcome of their meeting in the Malaysian capital. "I would call it a pathway toward peace," he said. Shahusek also said that the agreement wasn't the result of a third-party mediation, an apparent reference to the U.S. The challenge now falls to Japan, where Trump on Monday will sit for a courtesy call with Emperor Naruhito. The next day, Trump is likely to enjoy a warm reception by new Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi and attend a grand dinner with prominent business leaders. Meanwhile, South Korea has the challenge of hosting Trump in a non-capital city, Busan, before he attends the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in a much smaller one, Jeonju. The two governments have already pledged to increase military spending and invest nearly $900 billion in the U.S. as they work to secure their trade and security relationship with Washington. Technology: what broke for you when AWS went down? Plus, try an AI browser, Sam Altman's too big to fail year, and the tech CEOs who talked Trump out of San Francisco's surge in this edition of the technology newsletter. Power, water, telecommunications, these are all utilities we can't do without. On Monday, America added another critical utility to that list. It's called Amazon Web Services. AWS's largest hub based in Northern Virginia crashed and unleashed a slew of problems that nobody saw coming. Wordle addicts panicked that their long-running streak would be reset to zero. Students fretted over blown deadlines as their Canvas learning portals stopped working. SmartBed stopped working, cryptocurrency owners stopped trading, and automated soccer referees stopped calling fouls on the field. What made Monday's outage remarkable was the fact that so many people who weren't AWS customers themselves felt pain during the 14-hour disruption. That's because Amazon keeps many of the apps and websites we use every day online. It could have been worse. Monday's outage took out only one of about 36 global AWS hubs. By the end of the week, Amazon explained what had happened. An automated software tool made a mistake that clobbered what is likely the world's largest database, an Amazon product called Amazon DB. It didn't work for 2.5 hours. And because Amazon itself needed that database for more than 140 of its products to work properly, that outage kicked off a cascade of failures. It turned out that in a day of surprise dependencies, the biggest surprise was how much Amazon itself needed AWS. Nicole Wynn, I tried an AI web browser and now I'm a convert. I've been using several AI web browsers lately. I'm never going back to the boring old kind. An AI browser has built-in chatbot that can see what's open in your tabs. As you surf, you can type requests like, explain this. Is this the best price? Make it vegetarian. Your artificial intelligence browsing assistant instantly understands the context. Julie Jargon, afraid to try AI, these tech-savvy seniors will change your mind. I recently convened a panel of tech-savvy seniors who are all in on AI to find out how they're using chatbots in their personal lives. They offered use cases that can teach us all a thing or two, and they explained what can go wrong. Christopher Mims, Geothermal's Drill Baby Drill Moment, How New Tech is Unlocking Earth's Heat. America has an effectively limitless supply of energy waiting to be tapped right beneath the feet of hundreds of millions of its citizens. The equipment required to get at its almost 100% domestic or comes from nearby allies. And politicians on both sides of the aisles love it, unlike other low-carbon renewable resources. How Sam Altman tied tech's biggest players to OpenAI. To achieve his vision of securing seemingly endless computing power for OpenAI, Sam Altman has gone on a deal-making blitz, playing the egos of Silicon Valley's giants off one another. The resulting game of financial one-upmanship has tied the fates of the world's biggest semiconductor and cloud companies and vast swaths of the U.S. economy to OpenAI, essentially making it too big to fail. AI workers are putting in 100-hour work weeks to win the new arms tech race. Inside Silicon Valley's biggest AI labs, top researchers and executives are regularly working 80 to 100 hours a week. Several top researchers compared the circumstances to war. The core group is facing a relentless grind, racing to keep pace with seemingly endless cycle of disruption in pursuit of systems with superhuman intelligence. SF's rebound. San Francisco is back, or at least on its way. Crime rates have dropped. Homeless tent encampments that block sidewalks and bedevil retail businesses have shrunk, and foot traffic and transit riderships have risen. No surge. President Trump was ready to send troops into San Francisco. The city's business leaders needed a way to talk him out of it. A frenzy of phone calls and text messages between Trump members of his administration, Mayor Daniel Lurie and chief executives of major Bay Area technology companies led Trump to call it off. OpenAI lawsuit. OpenAI twice loosened ChatGPT's rules for discussing suicide in the year before 16-year-old Adam Rain took his own life using a method the chatbot advised him on, according to an amended lawsuit filed by his parents on Wednesday. OpenAI said strong protections for minors, especially in sensitive moments, is a top priority. China. U.S.-China sound confident note after trade talks. Scott Bessent hails very successful framework for Trump-Xi meeting as Beijing reports preliminary consensus on key issues by Hannah Mao and Chun Han Wang. Top U.S. and Chinese negotiators sounded a positive note on weekend trade talks, hailing what they called constructive discussions ahead of a meeting between President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping planned for this week. I think we have a very successful framework for the leaders to discuss on Thursday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said after 2 days of trade negotiations in the Malaysian capital. Chinese Vice Commerce Minister Li Chengdeng separately told reporters that the two sides have reached preliminary consensus on possible solutions for issues that have rocked relations between the two largest economies. The talks covered a range of issues, including export controls, extensions to the suspension of reciprocal tariffs, and cooperation to tackle the illicit trade in fentanyl, according to Bessent and Lee. They also discussed purchases of agricultural products, access to rare earths crucial to making everything from cars to jet fighters, TikTok, and the overall U.S.-China relationship, Bessent said. The U.S. have been tough in conveying its position, whereas China has been firm in defending its own interests and rights, said Lee, a top aide to Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng, who headed the Chinese delegation. The trade talks in Malaysia aimed to ratchet down tensions between the countries and lay the groundwork for further discussions at the expected Trump-Xi summit, which will be the first in-person meeting of the two leaders since Trump began his second term. When asked whether the U.S. and China would extend a trade truce set to expire November 10th, during which both countries agreed to lower tariffs, Bessent said, "Coming out of this meeting, I would say yes, but that is the end of the day President Trump's decision." Bessent later said on ABC's This Week that he thinks that the U.S. has averted having to impose 100% tariffs on China that Trump threatened to put in place if Beijing moved ahead with plans to restrict the imports of rare earth minerals. "I believe they are going to delay that for a year while they re-examine it," Bessent said. Trump would likely visit Xi in China in early 2026, while Xi might visit the U.S. later next year, Bessent told NBC News in a separate appearance. Li, the senior Chinese negotiator, said both sides will now go through internal approval processes for implementing their preliminary consensus. He didn't offer specifics from the talks. Trump arrived in Kuala Lumpur on Sunday for a regional gathering of Southeast Asian leaders, his first stop on a trip that will include Japan and South Korea, where he is expected to meet Xi. Trump, speaking aboard Air Force One en route to Malaysia, said he hoped to leave the Xi meeting with a complete deal, saying, "We have a really good chance of making a really comprehensive deal." The president has said he would press China to resume purchases of U.S. soybeans, crack down on Chinese companies exporting chemicals used to make fentanyl, and ease controls on rare earths. China this year has pulled back on the purchases of U.S. soybeans, badly squeezing American farmers, a core constituency of the president. Bessent on ABC's This Week said he and China's vice premier had agreed on substantial agricultural purchases for U.S. farmers and for Beijing to help the U.S. control precursor chemicals fueling the fentanyl epidemic. He didn't disclose details of the trade agreement, saying he didn't want to get ahead of Trump on the announcement. But I think we have addressed the farmers' concerns, he said. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. The meetings in Malaysia were the fifth highest level talks between the two superpowers this year in a volatile trade war that has at times sent financial markets and businesses reeling. After ratcheting up tariffs in each other's goods past 100%, earlier this year, the two sides in May reached a tentative truce to roll back duties. Friction between the U.S. and China reignited in recent weeks, with each country accusing the others of escalating tensions. At the end of September, Washington expanded a trade blacklist targeting Chinese tech companies. Beijing earlier this month tightened controls on rare earths. The new rare earth measures from China shocked and angered Washington. Beijing's introduction of rare earth export controls earlier this year led to significant production disruptions for U.S. car makers and other companies. The Trump administration expects China to increase exports of rare earth magnets as a condition for the U.S. lowering tariffs. Before the Malaysia trade talks, which were held on the 92nd floor of Kuala Lumpur's Merdeka 118 skyscraper, both sides made moves to build up leverage. The U.S. opened a new investigation that could set the stage for potential tariff increases, looking into how the Chinese government has upheld its end of so-called Phase 1 trade deal that it signed during Trump's first term, in which China pledged to greatly increase its purchases of American goods. China said it has fulfilled its obligations under the agreement. In response to U.S. fees on Chinese ships calling at American ports, Beijing said it would impose a special fee on U.S. vessels docking in China and sanctioned U.S. subsidiaries of a South Korean shipbuilder. Last month, both sides reached a framework deal on TikTok, paving the way for a deal that would allow the Chinese-owned video sharing app to operate in America. Policy. Trump says he will raise tariffs on Canada by 10% over Ontario ad. The measure was in response to what the U.S. president calls misrepresentation of Ronald Reagan's comments by Gavin Bade, Vipal Manga, and Natalie Andrews. The U.S. will impose an additional 10% tariff on Canada, President Trump said on Saturday, a punitive measure in response to an ad campaign that he said misrepresented comments by former President Ronald Reagan. Because of their serious misrepresentation of the facts and hostile act, I am increasing the tariff on Canada by 10% over and above what they are paying now, Trump posted on his Truth Social platform on Saturday. The ad campaign released by the Canadian province of Ontario uses audio from a 1987 radio address delivered by Reagan, in which he explains that despite putting tariffs on Japanese semiconductors that year, he was committed to free trade policies. While tariffs can look patriotic, Reagan said, over the long run, such trade barriers hurt every American worker and consumer, lead to fierce trade wars, and result in lost jobs. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, in an appearance on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, called the ad a kind of propaganda against U.S. citizens. What was the purpose of that other than to sway public opinion, he asked. Trump had threatened to cut off trade talks with Canada on Thursday over the ad, claiming it misrepresents Reagan's comments and was being used to influence the U.S. Supreme Court ahead of a hearing on the administration's tariffs next month. In response, Ontario Premier Doug Ford said that he would call off the campaign effective Monday, but the ad still ran on Friday night during the first game of the World Series, a fact that Trump noted in his Saturday post, saying the ad was to be taken down immediately. The ad ran again Saturday night during the second game of the World Series. U.S. tariffs on Canada currently stand at 35%, which, with U.S. with energy products at 10%, but goods that comply with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, are carved out of the duties, meaning that about 85% of Canadian exports to the U.S. come in tariff-free. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has removed most of the retaliatory tariffs that his predecessor Justin Trudeau imposed. The White House didn't respond to a question on when the new tariffs take effect, if USMCA-compliant goods would be exempted on the additional levies, and what authority the U.S. is using to impose these tariffs. As the Prime Minister said yesterday, we stand ready to build on the progress made in constructive discussions with American counterparts over the course of recent weeks, said Canada's Minister in charge of Canada-U.S. trade, Dominic LeBlanc, in a post on X. A spokeswoman for Ford had no immediate comment. The U.S. is Canada's largest trading partner, and Canada is the second largest for the U.S., with bilateral trade and goods reaching nearly $762 billion in 2024. Goods not included in the USMCA include many agricultural and energy goods. Trump first posted about the ad on Thursday night after the Reagan Foundation released a statement claiming that the ad misrepresented the president's comments and that the audio was used without its permission. Trump called the ad fake at the time and on Saturday claimed that Reagan loved tariffs for the purposes of national security and the economy, but Canada said he didn't. The Reagan Foundation hasn't said what it found inaccurate about the ad, and a spokeswoman didn't respond to a request for comment on the new tariffs. While Reagan's speech acknowledges an action to put tariffs on Japanese semiconductors, most of the address is devoted to explaining why tariffs, especially broadly applied, lead to bad outcomes. In certain select cases, like the Japanese semiconductors, we've taken steps to stop unfair practices against American products, Reagan says in the address. But we still maintained our basic long-term commitment to free trade and economic growth. On Friday, Carney told reporters before getting onto a plane bound for the Association of Southeast American Nations Summit in Kuala Lumpur that he remained open to keeping talks going with the U.S. Both he and Trump will attend a working dinner for Asia-Pacific leaders Wednesday in South Korea and are likely to see each other there, a senior U.S. official said. Artificial intelligence. It's not just rich countries. Tech's trillion-dollar bet on AI is everywhere. As part of AI decolonization, developing nations push Silicon Valley to build locally. By Stu Wu. Tap water isn't drinkable. Power outages are common. The national average wage is $2,200. Yet rising on Jakarta's outskirts are giant windowless buildings packed inside with NVIDIA's latest artificial intelligence chips. They mark Indonesia's surprising rise as an AI hotspot, a market estimated to grow 30% annually over the next 5 years to $2.4 billion. The multi-trillion dollar spending spree on AI has spread to the developing world. It is driven in part by a philosophy known in some academic circles as AI decolonization. The idea is simple. Foreign powers once extracted resources, such as oil, from colonies, offering minimal benefits to the locals. Today, developing nations aim to ensure that the AI boom enriches more than just Silicon Valley. Regulations effectively require tech companies such as Google and Meta to produce local data domestically. That pushes companies to build or rent data facilities onshore instead of relying on global infrastructure. These investments add up to billions of dollars and create jobs that foster national talent, or so developing nations hope. The model is shaping up where it has to be more fair to the country, said Vikram Sinha, chief executive of Indostat Ooredoo Hutchison, a partially government-owned Indonesian telecom provider building data center projects across the country. AI decolonization is a twist on data sovereignty, a concept that gained traction after Edward Snowden revealed that American tech companies cooperated with U.S. government surveillance of foreign leaders. The European Union in 2018 pioneered data protection laws that other nations have since mimicked. Regulations vary by country and industry, but the principle is this. If a developing nation bank wants an American tech giant to store customer data and analyze it with AI, the bank must hire a company with domestically located servers. Combined with genuine business demand for AI computing, such regulations have made some less wealthy nations beneficiaries of the AI boom, including in South and Southeast Asia. Google recently committed $15 billion over 5 years to build an AI center in India. Amazon Web Services is investing $5 billion to increase infrastructure in Thailand. Data centers in Indonesia earned $374 million in revenue last year, said research firm Mordor Intelligence, a figure estimated to sextuple by 2030. Betting big on this new sector is Indosat, Indonesia's second largest telecom provider. Its CEO, Sinha, was emboldened by NVIDIA chief executive Jensen Huang, who championed sovereign AI during a visit to Jakarta last year. No country can afford to have its natural resources, the data of its people, be extracted, transformed into intelligence, then imported back into the country, Huang said at an Indostat event. Sinha has a chance to ask Huang for advice during a dinner. He recalled the answer. If you believe in something, go all in. To Sinha, the belief is AI. Indostat plans to increase its AI-enabled server power to 500 megawatts by 2028 from 20 megawatts currently, and data centers with backup electricity. By comparison, said research firm DC Byte, the American hub of Virginia has about 38,000 megawatts of capacity live or in planning. The industry rule of thumb is $10 million a megawatt, so a $5 billion investment for Sinha. He thinks Indostat's Indonesian economics can reduce the cost to 70% of that. Potential clients include Indonesian customers and American tech giants, who outside the U.S. often use local partners instead of building their own facilities. Sinha said Indonesia's data center boom would supercharge the economy and boost the tech talent pool. Other experts are less certain. After construction, each megawatt of a data center supports only one permanent job, said James Murphy, Asia Pacific Managing Director of DC Byte. And even if built in developing nations, many data centers remain foreign-owned. The ultimate beneficiaries are the large tech companies and their investors, said Govind Aziz, a political economist at Sydney's Macquarie University, who researches tech sovereignty in Southeast Asia. Business. Boeing defense workers reject latest contract. St. Louis area machinists have been on strike since early August. By Drew Fitzgerald. Roughly 3,200 striking St. Louis area Boeing workers will stay on the picket line after members rejected a modified contract proposal for a fourth time. The local IAM 837 union said its members voted down the aerospace company's new five-year contract proposal. The company said its proposal failed by a 51% to 49% vote. Workers at Boeing's St. Louis area plants helped assemble jet fighters, trainer aircraft, and bomb kits. Union representatives have called Boeing's previous offers insulting and pointed to recent wage gains by workers in the company's Northwest commercial operations. The St. Louis factory work on jet fighters at a relatively lower volume, but area production is expected to surge as the company prepares to build its next generation F-47 Air Force jets in the coming years. Bowen can't keep playing favorites between regions and expect our members to accept less. Junie Bennett, IAM, Resident General, Vice President, said in a statement. The St. Louis machinist walked off the job in early August after narrowly rejecting an earlier four-year contract proposal. In September, they rejected a third proposal that included a $4,000 lump sum signing bonus. The most recent proposal, which wasn't endorsed by the union, added a new restricted stock and retention awards while lowering some other progression-based wage figures. The St. Louis workers are striking after a contract was reached last year for 33,000 machinists who assemble Boeing's commercial aircraft in the Pacific Northwest. Those Seattle area workers, frustrated by years of stagnant real wages and the soaring cost of living, went on strike for nearly 8 weeks. The walk-off yielded them a 38% wage increase over 4 years and a $12,000 signing bonus. The St. Louis area union represents a smaller share of Boeing's workforce than its commercial lines in Washington state. The manufacturer has leaned on managers in recent weeks to keep production on track for weaponry like Joint Direct Air Munitions or JDAMs. Boeing Chief Executive Kelly Ortberg told an investor conference in September that the St. Louis strike had slowed down some work on F-15 and F-18 jet fighters. Production of JDAMs continued apace during the strike. Steve Parker, the head of Boeing's defense business, said in a letter to workers earlier this month that the company was willing to make modifications without budging on the overall contract's value. The strike is costing you, and more time on the picket line won't result in more money, he said. Russia. How Russia's sanctioned Arctic gas found a Chinese loophole. The U.S. and allies aimed to hobble Russia's energy industry, but Moscow has found workarounds. By George Kanchev and Rebecca Fang. To understand how effective U.S. sanctions on Russia oil could be, look no further than the already sanctioned Arctic gas project central to Moscow's export ambitions. In multiple rounds of blacklisting, the Biden administration crippled the logistics, shipping, and financing ecosystem around the natural gas facility known as Arctic LNG 2, publicly aiming to leave it dead in the water. Yet since August, Russia has managed to send 11 tankers full of liquefied natural gas from the plant, ship tracking data shows. On the receiving end, China's port of Beihai, a city famed for its picturesque beaches that once served as a key stop along the ancient maritime Silk Road, now it has emerged as a crucial node in the export of sanctioned gas from the Russian Arctic. It benefits both the Chinese economy and the Russian war machine, said Alexander Gubev, who is the director of the Carnegie Russian Eurasia Center and focuses on China-Russia relations. China no longer feels the need to be overly concerned about the U.S. reaction. The U.S. and its allies have tried to cripple Russia's energy industry since the invasion of Ukraine, but Moscow has found loopholes time and again. The Beihai Gas Road has become a key channel for that effort and a means to further deepen its ties with China. The latest sanctions came last week when the Trump administration imposed new measures on Rosneft and Lukoil, Russia's two largest oil exporters. On the same day, the Iris, a tanker the length of nearly three football fields, docked at Beihai in southern China carrying LNG from the sanctioned Russian gas facility. Evading sanctions is a national priority as Russia tries to shore up its war chest, an especially urgent task this year for the country's as the country's economy has begun to falter. For Beijing, it is as much an opportunity to snap up discounted Russian fuel as it is a signal of defiance in its trade war with the U.S., where China's leverage over vital rare earth exports has made it less concerned about American sanctions, observers say. China and Russia show little effort to disguise the trade, with tankers carrying the sanctioned cargoes continuing to broadcast their positions through so-called AIS transponder signals. Russia's oil and gas exports, traditionally a source of cash and geopolitical heft for the Kremlin, have declined since it lost most of the European market. Although Moscow has been able to find new buyers for its oil, which is more easily transported by ship, replacing lost volumes of gas that used to flow through fixed gas pipelines has proved harder. That made the $25 billion Arctic LNG 2 project essential for the Kremlin and a natural target for Western sanctions. LNG plants work by cooling natural gas until it becomes a liquid, which shrinks its volume and makes it easier to transport by ship. The facility is central to Russia's ambition to more than triple LNG exports in the coming years. Building it meant transporting colossal concrete platforms called gravity-based structures, each exceeding 600,000 tons and among the heaviest objects ever moved. In December 2023, the first of three liquefaction plants, known in the industry as trains, was completed. Exports were supposed to begin in the first quarter of the last year, but then U.S. sanctions imposed on the project began to kick in. The U.S. has hit Russia's fledgling LNG industry with several waves of sanctions since the war began. It has targeted operating companies for the Arctic LNG 2 projects, storage vessels, shipping companies that it suspected were seeking to buy specialized carriers for the project, and companies working on other facilities. That gummed up financing and logistics for Arctic LNG 2 and stopped South Korean shipbuilders from delivering to the project. It also made it hard for Russia to build alternative vessels domestically. As a result, LNG output ground to a halt last year, leaving the facility mostly recirculating already produced gas. That's where Beihai comes in. China became the world's largest LNG importer in 2021, with cities, factories, and power plants shifting away from coal and requiring ever more gas for heat and electricity. Imports climbed 7% in 2024 to 76 million tons, according to the country's customs. The Beihai LNG terminal opened for business in April 2016 and has been continuously expanded since. It provides a steady supply of gas to China's southern provinces, including Yunnan, Guangzhou, Hunan, Guangdong, and Fujian. The Arctic LNG 2 gas is attractive for China because it comes at a discounted rate to other LNG in the region. But to buy it without risking secondary U.S. sanctions, China has made the port of Beihai its de facto entry point. No other LNG carrier has docked in Beihai since the terminal started accepting gas from Russia. The operator of the terminal, state-owned China Oil and Gas Pipeline Network, mostly owns assets in China with limited exposure to the dollar-based financial system, said Martin Senior, analyst at data provider Argus. That makes the port and its owner much less prone to the risk of secondary U.S. sanctions, he said. The U.S. hasn't sanctioned the facility, though the UK slapped sanctions on the terminal earlier this month, calling it an entity involved in supporting the Russian energy sector. At the time, China's foreign ministry spokesman said that China consistently opposed unilateral sanctions that lack a basis in international law. China also has provided the project with components, such as turbines, that Russia can no longer obtain from the West. To transport the gas, Russia has redeployed tankers from other sites and used some old ones, including from the so-called shadow fleet of vessels that rely on opaque ownership and shell companies, according to Jan-Erik von Rich, senior analyst at consulting firm Rystad Energy. Challenges remain for Arctic LNG 2. Russia still needs more tankers, and new vessels are unlikely to be delivered soon. Orders for key high-efficiency turbines were canceled under sanctions, and the Chinese replacements are less powerful, cutting the export capacity of the facility, said Robert Songer, LNG markets analyst at data provider ICIS. Other buyers, meanwhile, are wary of the legal and logistical risks of buying gas from the project, he said. Not so for Beijing, a reality that doesn't bode well for the effectiveness of this network's oil sanctions on Russia, according to Ronald Smith, founding partner of Texas-based Emerging Markets Oil and Gas Consulting Partners. In the much smaller world of LNG trade, demotivating buyers could be easier than doing so for buyers in the much larger oil market, he said. Lube heist investigation yields first arrests. Police made the arrests as one of the suspects was preparing to take a flight out of France by Stacy McTree and Nick Kustoff. French police have made their first arrests in connection to the heist at the Louvre Museum, according to prosecutors, including one man who was intercepted before he could board a flight to flee France. Paris prosecutor Laura Becquiot said police detained men Saturday evening after learning that one was planning to leave France from Charles de Gaulle Airport on the northern outskirts of the capital. Becquiot didn't provide further details on the man or anyone else police detained, and a spokesperson for the prosecutor's office declined to comment. The arrests provide the first sign of whether France is making progress in its sweeping dragnet to track down people involved in the stunning heist last Sunday that saw thieves break into the Louvre in broad daylight and make off with the country's crown jewels. Becquiot, however, criticized informed individuals for disclosing details to French media that reported earlier on the arrest, suggesting this undercut investigators who spent the past week scrambling to track down the thieves and recover the jewels before they're sold off. I deeply deplore the hasty disclosure of this information, she said, adding, this revelation can only harm the investigative efforts of the 100 or so investigators deployed in the search for both the stolen jewelry and all the criminals. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.